Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look into all the grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmanel, and I'm your host. On today's program, music, the fairness doctrine, net neutrality, pick your buzzword. It's all about media. You do want to stay tuned. Before we get started, I'm just going to remind y'all that this is this program, which I greatly enjoy doing here, is a still very much a personal enterprise, which is now about to celebrate its 7th anniversary on the airwaves. The first salvo, shall we say, in the Media Geek War for Goodness and Righteousness was fired off in March of 2002 at Community Radio WEFT at 90.1 FM in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, and has now grown to about 14 stations around North America, including Canada. Welcome, my Canadian friends. The show is now originated at WNUR in Evanston, Illinois, here on the beautiful lakeside campus of Northwestern University. And through this all, I've had some help through the years from various folks. Drew Tirico helped me on early on. He was a great help and producer for the program. And recently here at WNUR, Andrew Godhelf, a journalism student and someone behind sports broadcast here at WNUR, was also lending a hand. But it's been mostly a personal enterprise, bringing you news that I think is important, and along with interviews with folks who I think have something interesting to say or share. I really like to talk to, when it comes to interviews, I like to talk to people who are a little outside the mainstream, and even like, say, shall we say, outside the mainstream of progressive or non-commercial media, less interested in talking to the Noam Chomskys of the world than I am to somebody who might not otherwise be heard from on the airwaves. That said, that's my way of saying that no interview this week. I worked pretty hard to try and get something, but between my having to schedule around having an actual day job and limited availability, and also have other people who I might wonder if you have schedules, we're not quite able to come through. But then I take the opportunity to talk about things that I think are pretty important in communications news, especially. Because when it comes to media and communications news, I think it's important for us to understand the things which might restrict or help us communicate and receive good communications. And with the rise of the internet and lots of policies that could be in front of us that could dictate our ability to be free there, it's very important for us to understand. I try to break it down as much as I can to plain language and really kind of bring out some of these issues. So I threw out some buzzwords at the beginning of the program, and you know what I want you to listen to first, though, is this.
Well, what can I do?
You could play that 16th note groove just straight. Going, you'll be amazed.
Okay.
Do it again.
More than one guitar part. There'll okay. be somebody playing single notes, somebody playing chords, and they'll mix them together.
Okay. And let's just pick the mother of all funk chords. Let's pick a ninth chord.
Now, because this is radio, you can't see the visual here, but there's a good chance that you might have already seen this. This is something which is only about a week old on the internet. A piece put together by a artist who goes by the name Kutiman, K-U-T-I-M-A-N. It's already been viewed a million times on YouTube, but what's interesting about this is that what it is this is a complete remix and mashup of amateur musicians who have posted themselves playing to YouTube. And this is something you may or may not realize, that all sorts of so-called woodshedders, people who play guitar and practice at home or playing a variety of instruments, often upload videos of themselves showing off or demonstrating how to play a particular piece or play a particularly difficult run or doing their own unique take or cover on a particular song. Well, this guy Kudiman has taken together massive numbers of these amateur musicians and cut them together in video and audio to be playing a tune all together. And it's just spreading like wildfire. But the reason why I bring it up to you, the reason why I have this here on Media Geek is not because I want to jump on the next hot net meme, because it actually brings to the forefront a number of issues about our communications freedom here. Because this is reappropriation culture, right? And you may have heard people argue through the years, and especially to like the Supreme Court and in lots of books, Professor Larry Lessig of Stanford, formerly of Stanford University, that so much of what we take as popular culture of rock and folk music, even classical music, was actually built upon, you know, appropriating and reinterpreting works of the past into new forms. Whether it was listening to blues licks, which would eventually become the Rolling Stones or Led Zeppelin, or the Brandenburg variations as recorded by Bach. But that's been lost in modern copyright law because sampling, which is exactly what's happening in this piece you hear behind me, is more or less illegal unless you get explicit permission for samples as short as even a few bars and pay through the nose for it, taking away the ability really to reuse and reappropriate culture. And it's something which there's been a great movement afoot in the last 10 years or so to try and correct in copyright law and to encourage people to allow sharing and to do sharing. But this is important not just for the issue of copyright, but for the issue of network neutrality. And I want to point you to an article, post put up by Tim Carr of Free Press at SaveTheInternet.com, if you go there right now. It's a post called "The Future Begins Through You." And this is something that was immediately occurred to me, and then I saw Tim had already written up something very cogent about it. Because one of the things in front of us that could happen very soon is that the major internet service providers that we have, Comcast, AT&T, on, are talking about implementing filtering, implementing safeguards, looking for copyrighted content, looking for and policing the reuse or the sharing of files. Now, we've all heard of file sharing. We've heard of people being sued by the Recording Industry Association of America. A topic that's been talked about quite a bit on the Media Geek radio show has been how Comcast blocked peer-to-peer traffic, the file sharing using the BitTorrent protocol, which isn't just used to share music or movies, but also used as a way to help people download software or other large files that would be very expensive to host on a website. But in a world in which sampled works, in which copyright is being enforced and sniffed out extra legally by the Comcast, AT&T's, your internet service provider, could make a video like this illegal. Or if not illegal, it would just stop it from being, whether it was legal or not. That's the thing, by the copyright detection happening in an extra legal sort, being taken on basically in a vigilante sense by your internet service provider, could mean that this sort of creative reappropriation you would never even see and you couldn't even share. And clearly, this is something which is catching on. A million people have already watched this on YouTube in a matter of about a week as I go to air here. And popularity itself is not necessarily a measure of merit, I would argue. And yet it is an indicator. It is an indicator of the fact that culture has been taking this turn for quite some time, and it is certainly hitting mainstream. Remember, a million sales of a song used to be considered a platinum record. Right, that was a big thing for someone to go for. If a single had a million sales, That was considered a platinum record. While certainly Cootie Man has not made necessarily any direct money on sales of this particular track to YouTube, he's attracted 1 million visitors. This is certainly something which is catching on in a big way. And so this is why I am here trying to cover issues like network neutrality, which I'll remind you is the principle that the internet should be uncluttered and free. And free not as in beer, but free as in speech. That you ought to be able to send communications unfettered, and they ought to be treated equally across the internet. A principle that was applied by virtue of policy and law to the internet until 2 years ago. It's the same principle which says that you can call somebody and speak freely on the telephone. It's called common carrier protection. So that you cannot be stopped from calling someone and speaking freely and have your speech abridged. The same was true for the internet. So that whether you were sending Skype data, whether you were sending a phone call, whether you were sending an MP3 or email, uploading something from a website or downloading something from a website, all that traffic would be treated equally. And it's something which the big ISPs have been fighting against, because they would certainly like to privilege their own content, especially AT&T's or Comcast, which are now in the cable game, who see the availability of legal or illegal content online, video, audio, as threats to their main business of trying to sell you stuff. Never mind that you're actually paying for your internet service. So here we have this little piece of culture. A few minutes on YouTube, which brings together all in one place the issues which we're facing about our communications freedom and future, whether or not someone could sit down and probably spend untold hours stitching together this very unique reuse of things that people shared on YouTube and have 1 million people see it. It's in front of us, and the reason why we should pay attention to issues like network neutrality and so on. And I will continue to cover it here on Media Geek, and have many times. And you can certainly go to the archivesradio.mediageek.net and look for things. Look for previous shows where I have covered that issue. It's pretty easy, too, because if you go along the right-hand side, there is there's the tag cloud, as it's called, and there's one for net neutrality. So all the shows where we've talked about and dealt with it, it's there, and there's a lot of them. So I encourage you to look there. Also go to the Media Geek website, MediaGeek.net, where I've also been talking about these issues. It looks like network neutrality is written into the stimulus package, in that money that goes towards building out broadband internet, that go towards perhaps bringing more broadband and different types of internet to rural areas especially, will also require that whatever those networks that are funded to also be non-discriminatory, right? When we put it that way, non-discrimination, it sounds pretty obvious, doesn't it? And so we're hoping that this may be a good year to restore and guarantee that there will be non-discrimination on the internet. So I'm going to get to a couple other news items here. Of course, in the last few months, I've been spending a lot of time on the unfortunate crumbling of the fourth estate of the press, as newspapers are having a rough time, even in television's having a rough time, radio's having an even tougher time. Some people see that it threatens journalism. It's created a large and, I think, fruitful debate about the future of online, the future of the internet when it comes to journalism information. But a segment of the press that I've always been a big fan of, ever since I first, I think, saw a copy of The Village Voice as a teenager growing up in New Jersey, is the so-called alternative press, the alternative weeklies, which really started out in the 1960s as very independent, often radical weekly newspapers, which were published as an alternative to the New York Times and the New York Post or the mainstream press. And the time since then, they've become somewhat more mainstream, one might argue, become really much more part of the fabric of mainstream journalism. Not so alternative, except that they tend to be free, driven by advertiser dollars, with a strong focus often on entertainment, on letting you know what's going on in your city. But still, the best of them able to continue to publish some fairly radical or cutting journalism in addition to opinion pieces. Well, one of the bigger owners right now is Creative Loafing Media, which is based out of Atlanta, and it's the owner of six so-called alternative weekly newspapers from around the U.S., including here the Chicago Reader. And it filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection back in September 2008. Well, now the company is in court with lender Atalaya Capital, I think that's how you pronounce it, A-T-A-L-A-Y-A, which is attempting to gain control of the company. Atalaya claims that the value of the company has dropped more than $7 million in the 3 months just after the company filed for protection, from $19 million in September to $11.4 million at the end of December. Well, how can it try and take control? Well, Atalaya lent more than $31 million to Creative Loafing just 2 years ago in 2007 so it could purchase the Chicago Reader and the Washington City paper. So these alternative weeklies, you know, are worth quite a bit. Were worth quite a bit of money there in 2007. And because it's owed more than what the company it claims is worth, it wants to take control. Well, what does that mean for so-called alternative weeklies? It's something I watch as someone who here in Chicago, and the time that I've spent in Illinois, would read the Reader both online and when I come into town, and I've watched it shrink from a paper that had multiple sections down to a single sort of tabloid that doesn't seem to have so much investigative journalism anymore, even if there are still some good columns and restaurant reviews, and you go looking in it for entertainment listings. And now see that someone might take it over. A lender might take it over, which sounds a whole lot like what's happened to Clear Channel Radio, which has been taken over by a private equity company. And in the process now is hemorrhaging more jobs, hemorrhaging more staff and personnel as it hemorrhages more money. And as local radio stations become even less local and even more centralized and even less relevant. And I fear what might happen to the Creative Loafing Media assets, although the company itself is attempting to fight off this attempt to take it over. So this is something to pay attention to, because it may be something we see happen to newspapers, especially if they're taken over hostily by the entities that to which they owe money, since most of them not really in the newspaper or journalism business. So what they're looking for is to just recoup some of their money, and they may not care how it happens. It's the unfortunate intersection of big money and newspapers. Well, speaking of money, and also Clear Channel, Billy Corgan, leader of the Smashing Pumpkins, thinks that radio stations should have to pay musicians and other performers for the right to play their music on air. That's what he told a hearing on the public performance right for sound recordings hosted by the House Judiciary Committee on March 10th. Currently, broadcast radio stations are required to pay a royalty to songwriters for the songs played on radio. But for more than half a century, radio has been exempted by law from having to pay performers. That means that when a station plays a song like Aretha Franklin's recording of Respect, a royalty payment goes to the songwriter, Otis Redding, but not Aretha herself. The rationale behind this performance royalty exemption is that radio serves as a vital promotional outlet, driving the sale of recorded music through which the performers benefit. However, one might argue that that was true more in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and maybe even the 90s than it is today, as the fortunes of the commercial radio industry slide into an abyss of debt, mismanagement, and lost audiences. Furthermore, many other media platforms that can play a similar promotional role, like satellite and internet radio, are themselves not exempt from performance royalties. They pay them. So that's pretty much the argument being made by a collection of interests representing musicians in the music industry, including the Recording Industry Association of America and the Future of Music Coalition. While he acknowledged the promotional role played by broadcast radio, Corgan told the Judiciary Subcommittee that, quote, if the performance of a song has value to a particular terrestrial radio station in its airing, I believe it is only right to compensate those performers who have created this work. Simply put, if a station plays a song, both the author and a performer should be paid. These particular performances must have value to the stations, or they wouldn't be playing them. End quote. Of course, the National Association of Broadcasters, the largest lobby representing radio broadcasters and television broadcasters, shot back. Their representative, Steve Newberry, said, quote, "Local radio stations provide new and emerging artists with needed exposure and access to a listening audience." End quote. He went on to note, quote, "Record companies and their artists benefit not just from radio airplay, but also from on-air interviews and promotions of local concerts and new albums." End quote. Of course, I say, is he talking about new local albums? When was the last time you heard much local music on your local commercial radio station? The NAB is also crying that the performance royalty would cause too much harm to what little profit is left in the commercial radio business. It's quite a fight when you see the Recording Industry Association of America squaring off with the radio, commercial radio industry and the broadcast industry. That's a pair of really hefty lobbies. And so this may work out less to being less about principle and less about what might be right or wrong and more about who's able to duke it out with the backroom dollars, who will be able to sway a little bit more. And in this sort of fight, you'll see, it's not a Democratic or Republican issue. It's a wallet issue. It's a campaign finance issue. It'll be interesting to watch this. I'm personally not throwing a dog into that race, although I do have small concerns about where non-commercial radio will fall into this, whether it's public, community, college radio. Simply because, unlike the broadcasters, we're not engaged in the business of selling airtime, selling commercials, or profiting from the music that gets played here. Arguably, non-commercial radio these days plays way more local artists, and in terms of new artists, especially ones that are not being pushed by a mainstream record label, if they're getting exposure on the radio, it's on non-commercial radio, and that is driving artists to get more exposure into the mainstream. Arguably, it is college radio which introduced the Smashing Pumpkins to a larger audience back in the early 90s. And in this time, with universities looking hard at their college radio stations and in some cases deciding to sell them off or consolidate control, turn them into public radio stations, I've reported here in the past, another expense to pay for music licensing may not be in their best interest, although fairly I can understand how the artists could have a complaint with the fact that this radio industry has been given an exemption for so long. So I'd like to see fair terms dealt out to non-commercial stations in all of this if it's going to go the way of royalties having to be paid by radio. That said, radio don't have a lot of money right now, but we'll have to see. And I've thrown out some questions on the Twitter feed today before going to air, and once again, I failed, absolutely failed to do this sufficiently ahead of time of the show. I keep saying each week I'm going to be putting out these questions days in advance, and instead I do it just a few hours in advance. But it was because I tweeted about the Cootyman video and asked what people thought. It's how Tim Carr directed me to what he'd written there. Tim Carr, you can see him at twitter.com/Tim Carr. As well, our friend of the show, the Retro King of Chicago, Bohush, said that he was ready to hate the Cootyman video, but ended up loving it. He says, "Usually I find appropriation art a skillless excuse for a failure of the imagination. However," he writes, "this rocks." And if you have any comments about the program or any questions I'm throwing out here, or anything you'd like to hear more of or less of, or do you know someone I should be talking to, someone who's creating interesting media in interesting ways, independent or has an interesting viewpoint on this big mess we're in, I'd love to hear about it. I'd love for you to share that intelligence with me, please. If you're using Twitter, you tweet me, twitter.com/MediaGeek. Send me an email. That's the old-fashioned way now. It's the new version of snail mail, paul@mediageek.net. And you know the radio show, of course, is at radio.mediageek.net. mediageek.net. I really, really would love to hear from you. Well, they voted for it before they voted against it. That's the answer the Senate has given regarding the question of banning the FCC from ever reinstating the Fairness Doctrine. Apparently, no herring is too red to take up precious floor time so that Democrats can prove they really aren't in support of a policy that's been dead for 25 years, but recently been dug up by right-wing talk show hosts and desperate Republicans. On March 11th, the Senate rejected a proposal to preempt a new Fairness Doctrine, which was due to be attached to a government spending bill under consideration. The amendment, sponsored by Senator John Thune, a Republican of South Dakota, would have withheld funding from the FCC if it dared to enforce the as-yet non-existent Fairness Doctrine anytime in the coming year. Thune's amendment was defeated not because of any great love for the Fairness Doctrine, but because there is pressure on Senate Democrats to strictly limit amendments so that the spending bill has a greater chance of passing. Never mind that the Senate already showed its antipathy for the doctrine in February when an amendment to restrict it was passed as part of the District of Columbia Voting Rights Bill. But that bill must not be moving fast enough since the House version hasn't been considered yet and the government finance bill is on a faster track. Of course, the irony of the Fairness Doctrine issue, and I don't use the word debate since almost nobody seems to be arguing in favor of it, is that there's no legitimate threat that the FCC or Congress has any intention of reviving it. The doctrine, which was eliminated by President George H.W. Bush's FCC, required broadcasters to seek opposing points of view in their programming, providing a degree of equal time to persons or groups wishing to oppose an opinion expressed on air. The bigger irony of the Fairness Doctrine brouhaha is that back in the day, conservatives and Republicans were equal opportunity users and abusers of the policy as much as any other political group. And a recent paper for the think tank, the Media Institute, and the Thomas Jefferson Center noted First Amendment attorney Floyd Abrams takes to task both liberals and conservatives for their on-again, off-again love affair with the Fairness Doctrine. Abrams, who defended the New York Times for its publication of the Pentagon Papers in the 1970s, says he had defended a television network against multiple Fairness Doctrine complaints made by the conservative watchdog group, Accuracy in Media. Abrams writes that when a documentary was aired that focused on problems with pension plans, quote, AIM maintained that not enough satisfied pensioners had been shown. When another one discussed sex education in schools, AIM claimed that not enough criticism of such efforts had been broadcast, end quote. Abrams is equally critical of some on the left who pine for the Fairness Doctrine since they see its demise as one of the key events that created right-wing talk radio. He argues that the same First Amendment that protected the publication of the Pentagon Papers also protects Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity. But the Fairness Doctrine continues to be at the top of their list, and since Rush Limbaugh is apparently the new leader of the GOP and the Republican National Committee, I guess it's got to be a top agenda in Congress, so much so they got to keep voting on it again and again and again. Hey, folks. That horse isn't just dead. It looks like a Slurpee. All hail Rush. And that brings to close another edition of Media Geek. I'll be back in one more week with more news and views on our media environment. In the meantime, go to MediaGeek.net. It's home to the Media Geek blog, where you can read news and views that there isn't time for in the program, such as what I learned about what the Library of Congress is doing to preserve our motion picture legacy, and about Indianapolis cops who have turned themselves into radio pirates. That's MediaGeek.net. And of course, our radio show is at radio.mediageek.net, where you can listen to the MP3s or subscribe to the podcast. If you have comments about the program, please send them to me, paul@mediageek.net. And of course, the Twitter feed is at twitter.com/mediageek. I'll be asking questions, and I'd love to hear your opinion about all sorts of issues of importance to our media environment. That's twitter.com/mediageek. And the show originates at WNUR in Evanston, Illinois, at 89.3 FM. And it's also heard on community stations all around North America, like KWMD in Kasilof, Anchorage, Alaska, and CJUM in Winnipeg, Manitoba. The show is free to air for your local non-commercial community radio station. Just go to radio.mediageek.net for details. Thanks for tuning in.